Luke chapter 16 this morning. We're in a study of parables. We dedicated our entire summer to that. And we have discovered that parables are one of the ways Jesus taught spiritual truths to his disciples. Sometimes he did that because he was trying to conceal truth from those that were around that maybe didn't agree with him or were hostile to Jesus. And he used this to teach many things. A lot of times it was things that had to do with finances. So last week, we stepped back. We were in the parable of the rich fool, the guy that had a great year, great crop, decided, hey, I'm going to tear down my barns, build bigger ones so I can store all my stuff. And the plot twist in the story was that he died that night. God took his life from him, and Jesus criticized him for being generous to himself but not generous towards God. This morning, we're going to be in another story with a plot twist, and it's going to teach us a little bit more about how we should view finances and how we should view preparing for the next life. Now, all of us love a good plot twist, me included. Sometimes you're watching a movie, and you're like, I didn't know that was going to be the bad guy. I should have known it. They put those little inklings in there. And sometimes it's like, I didn't know he was going to be the good guy. Like in the first Harry Potter movie, it's old, so you should have seen it. The one wizard, I thought, this guy's the bad guy. He turned out to be the good guy. He turned out to be on Harry's side. And it was kind of a good plot twist in that sense. Remember coming in a couple weeks ago, my wife's watching this romance movie, and I'm just picking up on all the details. And there was a plot twist, but it was like, if you didn't see it coming, you know, you were just so enamored with the story, you missed the details. And it's about this aging couple. Guy had a degenerative disease in his lung, and this young couple that just meet, and it gives this real speculative story. You don't realize it's speculative, but he actually had died at one point in the movie and was an organ donor to the other guy. And I said, you know what's going to happen? This guy's going to die, and that guy's going to live because he's going to get his organ. She's like, oh, I hope not. I've been sitting here. I'm so invested. You've ruined it for me. And it's exactly what happened. But, and again, it was cool because it was a true story. But the plot twist, they gave this little detail. When he went to get his driver's license, his girlfriend taught him how to drive in college, and he checked the organ donor box. I'm like, ah, that's the clue. Now, there's a plot twist this morning that some of you are going to see coming because you know this story if you've grown up in church. But for some of you, this might be new, and you're going to see a bad guy do some bad things, get in trouble with his boss, and then he does more bad things to cheat his boss. And we'll get to that, but like, here's what I want you to know this morning. If you walk away and you're like, Bridge Bible Church told me I need to cheat my boss this week, I'm going to throw something at you next week because that is not the point of the story. There's a plot twist here, and we want to see it coming. Now, to give you context, as I said, we're in Luke chapter 16 and verses 1 through 13. There's some important principles about wealth that we want to apply to our lives if we're committed to following Jesus. If you haven't committed to following Jesus yet, I want to invite you to consider that. And also, too, I want you to understand that the principles that we're going to follow from this book are there to show others, hey, we love Jesus. We want to do it his way. And we invite you to join that with us. But if you're a Christian this morning and you find out, hey, I'm reading this and I'm not doing these things, this is a great opportunity to make a course correction. And here's why course corrections are so important. So many times the watching world, they look at Christians and they say, they're all hypocrites. And what that used to mean was they're phonies. They're fakes. In fact, if you go to the Greek, they're literally play actors. They're playing a part to impress other people. But now what hypocrite has turned into in our culture is anyone that is less than perfect that calls himself a Christian is called a hypocrite. Here's the deal. We're called to be better than just forgiven, but you and I need to understand our life is a constant progression of course corrections so that our way follows the way of Jesus. So I invite you to make those corrections this morning if you need to. Now, I want to give you a little context. As I said, we're in Luke, but there's something you need to know about the Bible. It didn't always have chapters and verse markers. That was added later. And Jesus told a couple stories leading up to this one that were evangelistic in nature. About a month ago, you heard Mike Duma talk about the lost son, and the Pharisees were there and were present, and I wonder if the point of that story was to point out the fact that the Pharisees thought, we're so great, why do you love the lost son that returned, revealing the fact that they are lost, because they're not celebrating people, you know, the son that has come home. For us, that means people coming to Christ. We want to celebrate that like we did together a few minutes ago. But there's a context here, and he switches from evangelism to discipleship. He goes from telling stories, inviting people to follow him and to make a point about the kingdom, to say, hey, now that you're a kingdom follower, this is what you're supposed to do. So the question I want to get you into thinking about this morning is, what does it mean for you financially to be prepared for the future? A lot of people have a lot of different ideas about that. I mean, I've fallen down a YouTube rabbit hole ever since 2009, found all the prepper channels. Their idea is the apocalypse is coming. We're going to weather it in our bunker. And that's one way of looking at things. And there's other people that are like, no, it's about my retirement. Got to build that 401k. But you need to ask yourself, what has been your idea as far as preparing for the future? And I want to put it in these terms. Is your focus retirement or eternity? And if your focus is retirement, I want to just challenge you, not that it's bad to prepare for the future. The Bible talks about, you know, sharing the wealth, you know, to the ends of the earth for a thousand generations. It's important to be a good steward. But if just this life, this temporal existence becomes your focus, you might not be preparing for eternity the way that you should. So with that in mind, I want to give you this thought. The wise use wealth to prepare for eternity, while fools think only about this life. Let me say that again. The wise use wealth to prepare for eternity, while fools think only about this life. So with that, we're going to begin to walk through this parable. I invite you to join me in Luke chapter 16, verses 1 through 9. We read the ESV here at Bridge Bible Church. We believe it's one of the best modern word-for-word translations. And so if you have another translation, you're free to read along. Sometimes difficult to hear one thing and read another. Or you can join us by looking at the screen this morning. So he also said to the disciples in verse 1, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. Now, let me make a distinction between this story and some of the others. In the parable of the talents, you had these servants. The word is actually bond servant or slave. And they didn't have the option to opt out of managing their master's wealth. But one of them did, and he was the wicked servant. He was not living like someone trying to improve the master's assets. Remember, we talked about this anticipation of waiting for the return of Christ. So this is a different guy. This is a hired manager, not a bondservant or slave. So since he's not a slave, as you're going to find out as we go through the story, this guy can get fired. He's managing much bigger assets than just little tenant farmers. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. Some of the things that he does and the ways he cheats this master, it's like you're talking big bucks. You're talking Enron-type scandals, and he's got a really prestigious position that he squandered. So in verse 2, the master, it says, and he called to him and said, what is this I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so when I am removed from management, people will receive me into their houses. This man, you know, wicked servant, mismanager, embezzler, all those kinds of things, but very self-aware man. I'm not strong enough to do manual labor. That's out. I'm not going to beg, but I got an idea. So my fellow Jews will receive me into their house. Now, he's getting ready to play on a Jewish social construct called reciprocation. And in Jewish society, when someone did a solid for you, you owed them. See, in our world today, we tend to take as many solids as we can from others, and sometimes we're not so eager to repay. Or in fact, the better way in the church world is just to live a self-sacrificing life in serving others. But as one commentator put this way, he said, reciprocation was an integral part of Jewish society. If someone did a person a favor, the person was obligated to do one for him. So he's getting ready to play on that and use that to his advantage. So in verse 5 we read, so summoning his master's debtors, now again, he hasn't turned in the accounts yet, he says to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. It's like a little shadiness going on here. Now, let's stop for a minute. 100 measures of oil, some commentators say that's about 875 gallons of oil, or the yield of 150 olive trees and a harvest. So that's a lot of stuff. And one commentator valued it at 1,000 denarii, or 3 years' pay for a common worker. So imagine, this is like 3 years of, you know, middle-of-the-road salary, average pay for a laborer. And he's like, listen, chop that in half. Tell him instead of 100, you owe 50. Write it on the bill. Now, before we go too far with this, there's questions that are probably forming in your head. Because this is what we do as humans. Kid comes home with a story. You want all the details they're leaving out. Well, what did so-and-so say? Or what do you think so-and-so was thinking? How did you respond? What about this? What about that? But let me caution you, when we're interpreting a parable, it's very, very important to not get hung up on details that aren't there. Because if you get hung up on the details that aren't there, you're going to miss the point that Jesus has for us. So he says to another, verse 7, and how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. So he gave him a 20% reduction. 100 measures of wheat, 10 years of wages, talking about the yield of a crop. That is very valuable in farming culture. Now, you're probably asking, why does he do this? Well, think about this for a moment. These guys are in debt to his master, and he's kind of flipping it and making them in debt to him. And so here's the plot twist, verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. Now, let's be clear. He's commending him for his shrewdness. He's not commending him for his embezzlement or his mismanagement, but his shrewdness, his wisdom, his ability to think on his feet in the situation. And here's what the master goes on to say, because remember, this is a lot of times when you see the master, that's God or that's Jesus. He said, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. That's his conclusion. He's like, hey, these worldly, wicked people, when it comes to money, they're more shrewd, they're more wise in dealing with this generation than sometimes Christians are. And that's sometimes true. One commentator says this. He says, and it's precisely the surprise ending in which the master praises the unrighteous manager instead of punishing him that provides the point of the story. And you're probably sitting here going, well, is he going to file charges? You know, is he going to have them locked up? Or, you know, is it retributive culture? We're going to go hunting for this guy. No, the whole point is the master commends him for his shrewdness. See, the dishonest manager, he was managing, he was a steward of his master's accounts, and he used generosity of someone else's assets to make friends that were going to provide for his financial welfare for the rest of his life. That's what he was doing. Now, Jesus gives us the application of the next couple verses. So in verse 9, we read, and I tell you, this is Jesus, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. The one who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful with the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you with the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. So from those verses, I think there's three things Jesus wants us to walk away with. And I want to put them in a modern vernacular so we can understand what God wants from us when it comes to wealth. Now, here's the deal with principles of wealth in Scripture. They're all over the place. Jesus talks about money probably more than anything else because money is one of those things that will trip us up if we don't have guidelines and guardrails in our lives to help us know how to use and to share, to steward, and to bless others with money. And so it's very, very important that you understand money is that thing that can become an idol or a god to you over the God of the universe. So let me give you the first lesson that I think Jesus wants us to take away from here, and I think this one's pretty explicit. He says, use unrighteous wealth to make eternal friends. Use unrighteous wealth to make eternal friends. Let me unpack that for just a second. First of all, what is unrighteous wealth? Isn't money neutral? Well, if you think for a moment, money as we have it, it belongs to this world. It's kind of like our currency. It belongs to the U.S. Or if you have the Chinese currency, it belongs to them. And here's the deal with unrighteous wealth. It's not evil in and of itself. You could use it for evil things. But the bottom line is when your time is up, you don't take it with you. It stays here. It is unrighteous wealth. It does not make it into eternity with you. And we're told in verse 9, make friends by means of unrighteous wealth. Well, you think about the guy in the story. He made friends on this earth to take care of his needs. But what Jesus is talking about, he takes this bad example, this plot twist to teach us the spiritual truth that we are supposed to manage what God has given us in a way that we lead people to Jesus. See, he's speaking that as a way to remind us that the wealth we require in this world belongs to this world. You can't take it with you, but you could use it in evangelism to take other people with you. So disciples of Jesus use their wealth to make friends for eternity. Notice what it says in the second half of the verse. It says, so that when it fails, talking about unrighteous wealth, they may receive you into the eternal dwelling. Here's what this means. It's that phrase we talked about last week. You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. It's that if you use your assets to see people meet Jesus, then when you get to heaven, especially if they pass before you, they're going to be the ones welcoming you to their table, saying, because of you, I'm here. They're your eternal reward because you invested in them and you saw them meet Jesus. So how do we do that as a church? We've done that a lot of ways. We've used our church budget to build relationships. We've reimbursed leaders who've taken people out to eat to build a friendship. A couple years ago, we started buying shoes for Broomfield Elementary because we just wanted kids to start school with brand new shoes. Or help buy Christmas presents. And we didn't do that just for the sake of the shoes, but the idea was we wanted to build the friendship so that at some point in time we can introduce them to Jesus Christ. We didn't just buy Christmas gifts because we felt bad Santa wasn't coming to their house. We bought Christmas gifts because we wanted to build a friendship that would lead to an opportunity to talk about Jesus. That's why we do what we do. A few years ago, a long time ago, I was a brand new youth pastor, and I got my job, and I just finished my internship, and I called my youth pastor, who I'm still friends with to this day, and I said, what do I do now? I got the job. I'm at my desk. What do I do? And he's like, ask for some money to put yourself in front of as many people as you can. So we sent out postcards. If you come back with this postcard, we'll meet for a free ice cream. Or, you know, Starbucks was a big thing. Or, you know, went for the youth pastor diet for a long time. It consists of Chick-fil-A, Starbucks, and pizza. And I was always notorious for buying too much pizza at our fifth quarter parties that I'm sending whole pizzas home. There are families that love me. All they knew is Dave bought too much pizza again. It's a good night at our house. So we would use the church budget. And not a huge amount. Sometimes we have the kids pay to help offset, but we would use the unrighteous wealth of this world to build friendships that led to evangelism and discipleship. That is what we're called to do corporately, but it's also what we're called to do individually. Some of you do that very well. Someone ends up in a hospital, they're far from God. You bring them a meal. Or someone is going through a tough time, you buy them a book with spiritual truth in it. There's actually someone in our church who shared this story with me, and I wish I would ask for permission to share this, but I'll just ask for forgiveness since I'm not going to use names. But use their financial wealth to bless a member of the family who wasn't a believer. And he just couldn't understand, why are you willing to help me like this? Well, that's what we do as people that love Jesus. And that's what we are called to do, to use unrighteous wealth to make eternal friends. We want to see people end up in eternity. Now, this echoes something Jesus taught at the Sermon on the Mount. He said in Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. So you get all that nice stuff. I remember when I was 15, got this brand new hockey jersey. We just went to the Hockey Hall of Fame, took it to the rink, wore it in, put it in my bag, came back. It was stolen. It was gone. Never saw it again. Team Mussolini, number 8, Mighty Ducks, gone. Never saw it again. Paid a lot of money for that. But those nice things that we invest in, if we're not careful, we're investing in things that are very temporal. It says where moth and rust destroy. Think about that time you got that first ding on your car and it started to rust. It just kind of reminds you the car is very, very temporal. He says, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. When we invest in people, and people meet Jesus, and they become true Christ followers, something happens. It's an investment that you're never going to lose. How much time do we waste investing in things that fall apart, that wear out, that don't work? Listen, number one problem with that was when phones were like kind of new and becoming more and more advanced, I drove my wife crazy like every 6 months. This one does that. This will help me with this part of my job. This one does that. And I'm always like trading and wheeling and dealing. Eventually they all break. They all quit working. We want to invest in things that last forever. Or Proverbs 11:30, which reminds us, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and whoever captures souls is wise. If you invest in people because you want to see them live in eternity with Jesus Christ, you are wise. Here's the second thing that I think Jesus wanted us to take away. He says, your character will be revealed by your faithfulness. Your character ultimately reveals itself through whether or not you are faithful with what God has given you. Look at verse 10. One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. So you want to live a life of faithfulness? You don't wait till you have a lot to start becoming faithful. You start being faithful with what God has given you right now. There's a couple teens in our church that model this, and you don't even know it. They have jobs, and they every couple weeks they're throwing some cash in the offering. Really wish they'd keep record to learn to be, you know, good stewards at tax time, but they don't need the tax break just yet. That'll come later. But the fact that they're giving already shows that probably God's going to bless them because they're faithful with little, and God will honor that. He says, if then, if you've not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you the true riches? So God gives you, in this life, things to steward. One of those things is unrighteous wealth. Remember, wealth you can't take with you. And if you're not faithful with that, how is it going to give you anything spiritually significant to manage? Because you can't even manage the worldly stuff. And if you have not been faithful in which is another's, who will give you what is your own? It's the idea that, again, we are stewards. If you can't steward with this accountability to the master what belongs to him, why should you be entrusted with something that is that becomes your own? See, the principle here is we want to glorify God in our finances if we're Christians. And your faithfulness will ultimately reveal your character. And if you're waiting for God to give you more so that you can do something to honor him, it's probably not going to happen. Because he wants you to figure out how to honor him where you're at. Now, I want you to understand something. At our church, we believe in stewardship as a principle, not just that you give to get blessed. That's a lie straight from the pit of hell, and people are playing on individuals' greeds. But, you know, someone came to me a couple times. This actually happens a lot. I don't know why people tell me what they tell me, but I love them. And they said, I can't afford to give 10%. I said, well, then don't. If you can't eat and pay your bills giving 10%, what's going to happen is you're eventually going to have to come to us. We're going to find out about it. We're going to have to get the deacons involved and figure out how to feed you and help you get caught up. Rather, you take care of your responsibilities. But I said, what can you give God on a regular basis to show that your money belongs to him? I think if you're in financial dire straits, that's more important than feeling like you got to hit this mark. Now, if you have a lot of money and you're like, I want to please God, where do I start? I think 10% is a good place to start. But we believe in grace giving, and the Old Testament talked about the tithe, and it was actually closer to 23.8% when you added up all their tithes. But Jesus says, if you can, give it all. It all belongs to God. So we want to be faithful with what God has given us because our character will be revealed by what we do. And point number three, you only have room for one master in your life. There's only room for one. Look at what the text says. It says, no servant can serve two masters. Seems like common sense. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. You're either going to serve God or you're going to serve stuff. John Calvin said it this way, where riches hold the dominion of the heart, God has lost his authority. That's a huge quote. So if you love riches more than Jesus, riches has authority over you. Jesus does not. First John says this, do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life is not from the Father, but is from this world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. See, the principle here is to don't let yourself become a slave to wealth, especially if you claim Jesus Christ as your Lord. Now, let's unpack what that means. This could mean earning wealth. Some people just love to earn it. I had this former student, went to have coffee with him a few years ago. He was a student at Akron and had a pretty good job. I'm like, so he was always talking about how much he had. I'm like, he's like, you don't believe how much I have. I probably wouldn't. He's like, 30 grand. I'm like, how do you as a college kid have 30 grand in the bank and paying cash for a car and paying for your school? He was just addicted to earning wealth. Some people, it's accumulating, whether it's through earning or trading or investing. They just want to accumulate it. And for others, they just want to spend it. If that is your priority over pleasing Jesus, then money has become a god to you. So if you're a disciple and you're hearing all this, what do? Well, you look at those three principles that Jesus taught, that he reinforced after telling the story of this shrewd and wicked manager. And you remind yourself that you only have room for one master. Remind yourself that over time, your character and commitment to that master will be revealed by your faithfulness. And lastly, wise use their wealth to make eternal friends. See, the Christian and the wise use wealth to prepare for eternity, while the fools only think about this life. My invitation to you, Bridge Bible Church, continue to be wise. Continue to invest in missionaries. Continue to invest in gospel opportunities. Continue to invest in those that can help equip this body for ministering to the community. And may we stand before Jesus and be counted as wise servants who invested in eternity.